I think that they are possibly manned by intelligent observers who are members of a race that may have been investigating our Earth for centuries. I think that they possibly have been sent to conduct systematic long-range investigations, first of men, animals, and vegetation, and more recently of atomic centers, armaments, and centers of armament production. I have examined all of the arguments supporting the existence of flying saucers and denying it, and it is my conclusion that the unidentified flying objects do exist, are very real, and are visitors from outer space.
Dr. Hermann Oberth, for centuries, man was convinced that his planet Earth was the center of the entire universe. For centuries, he was convinced that his planet was flat. For centuries, he was convinced that the dragon god eclipsed the sun. And for centuries, he was convinced that we, Earthlings, are the only protoplasms in the universe blessed with a nice, pretty place to live. But today, the Earth is no longer the center, or is it flat, and the moon eclipses the sun. But still yet, there is no conclusive proof that we aren't, in fact, alone. No positive life has been found on the moon, no positive life evidence on Mars, no positive responses to our messages sent into space, and no alien visitors have appeared in public offering themselves for examination and display, and not even any tangible hardware from any spacecraft has ever been revealed. But yet over 10,000 sightings of flying vehicles of some kind are reported every year by pilots, policemen, clergymen, teachers, mayors, and even a young Georgian, Jimmy Carter. The nearest star is 4.25 light years away, over 24 trillion miles. That means that at the speed of light, it would take a vehicle some 4.25 years just to get here. And why would they come in this direction to begin with? And why would they come all this way without even bothering to stop and exchange ideas? This is Mike Eisner, and we intend to delve into these and other questions as we ask the very greatest of rhetorical questions. Are we alone? In a moment, we'll talk to Thomas Hyman of the UFO Education Center in California, a sort of clearinghouse for reports on UFO sightings. First, I think the best way to clarify the concept of UFOs versus extraterrestrial vehicular visits is with Dr. J. Allen Hynek, probably the foremost authority on the subject. Dr. Hynek is head of the astronomy department at Northwestern University and a consultant to the Air Force on UFOs for some 25 years now. It was Dr. Hynek who deemed strange Michigan sightings as swamp gas, and it was he who first coined the expressions close encounters of the first, second, and third kind.
That there have been strange things sighted in the sky and reported in the sky for many centuries is common knowledge. But the modern wave, you might say, or the modern era of UFOs really goes back not much more than 20 years or so.
Before we can really discuss the reality of vehicles from other planets, we must come to the conclusion that there is life on other planets capable of creating this transportation. Is there any doubt in your mind that this life does exist on other planets, Dr. Hynek?
None whatever, really. Statistically speaking, it would be quite strange if we were really alone. In fact, I think it would be cosmically provincial for us to think that we are the only intelligences in this universe. After all, the sun is but one star of 100 billion in our system, and there are billions of other systems, each containing roughly 100 billion stars. And for us to say that our sun is the only star that has planets around it would be, seems to me, a little bit like saying that my cat is the only cat that can have kittens, and no other cat in the world can have kittens except this. In other words, I think it would be statistically preposterous to believe that we are the only planetary system. And of course, if there are other planetary systems, perhaps it follows, I think it does personally, that there would be life on those planets. But I think we miss a very important point here, and that is that the UFO phenomenon may have nothing whatsoever to do with life elsewhere. Or, the conversely, if there is life elsewhere, it may have nothing whatsoever to do with the UFO phenomenon. What I'm trying to say is, let us for the moment suppose that life exists in many other solar systems. It does not follow at all that they could be visiting here on a regular basis. Or if they did, from time to time, it doesn't follow that the present UFO phenomenon, the reports of sight of craft and so forth, would have anything to do with that. Do you see the distinction there?
Mm-hmm.
In the answer to your question as to whether life exists on other planets of other solar systems, I would say it is extremely likely. Planets on our own solar system, so far the evidence seems to be rather doleful on that point. Certainly there does not seem to be any evidence on any of the planets of our solar system that intelligent, highly intelligent life exists.
It has been said that flying saucers or these unidentified flying objects have been observed for the past several thousand years. Then why then have they waited so long to come and meet us personally?
Well, first of all, that question has a lot of built-in assumptions that the UFOs are visitors from space and they are coming here to meet us and so forth. Probably, if I want to give a slightly facetious answer to why they haven't contacted us before, is it's probably because they have a superior intelligence.
Wouldn't you think that they would feel that they would benefit by talking to us in some way and sharing their knowledge, their superior knowledge, with us?
They may regard us, since you say we're speculating, and I want to certainly impress that on the audience that this is purely speculative. But after all, if we want to argue that other intelligences exist that are perhaps far more intelligent than we are, far more advanced, they might be looking upon us as we might look on a colony of worms. Why communicate? It will just disrupt things. And also they might be, if we go in this if business, I don't particularly care for this train of thought because I think it doesn't really touch the UFO problem. But it could very well be that if these are very highly intelligent beings of one sort or another, that they would not care to disrupt our evolution, our way of doing things, and they would realize that we are better left alone. We are on very dangerous ground here because we've not really laid a groundwork of what the UFO phenomenon is, what it is we're really talking about. The public has a great tendency to jump immediately. As soon as the term UFO is used, that means to the great majority of people that it means extraterrestrial craft. There are other possible explanations for the UFO phenomenon, the easiest of which, of course, and held by most scientists, is that it's sheer nonsense, purely imagination, hallucination. There is the hypothesis that what we're really seeing is the testing of some secret weapons and vehicles of one sort or another. Then there is, of course, the extraterrestrial hypothesis that we've been discussing here so far. And then there's the very broad and big hypothesis that maybe we are dealing with a phenomenon that's as yet unclassified, uncatalogued, in the same sense that nuclear energy, let us say, was unknown 100 years ago. So, apparently, we're more or less committed here, Dr. Beckman and I, to the program, to the idea that we are discussing visitors from outer space. And
then would we be safe in dropping the term unidentified flying object altogether and bringing up the term extraterrestrial vehicle?
It would be more honest in terms of our discussion here, but on the other hand, I think more honest all the way around if we were to speak of UFOs. And let me remind you, and remind all of us, that UFO means unidentified flying object. If we knew what they were, they would no longer be unidentified, they would be identified.
Mr. Fred Beckman of the University of Chicago and photographic analyst for Dr. Hynek's group in research.
Picture of a hubcap flying through the air, and if you can read Thunderbird or something on the side, this you can throw out immediately. However, the photographic quality of many of these pictures, for several reasons. One, because the thing is taken in a big hurry, and two, because the people who take them are not terribly experienced, tends to be quite poor. And so we don't check them off as fakes. We simply have to arrive at a probability as to the genuine
quality of the picture. I think it's the place to put in that it's always better to have more than just a photograph to work with. It's a very good idea to have some knowledge of the character and past and general reliability of the photographer, and we vastly prefer to have pictures which are witnessed, that is, the photographing of the object itself witnessed independently by other people. If the same object is photographed from several different positions, then we are able to determine such things as the exact position and size of the object. When we get a single photograph with no information or no reliable information about the photographer, we can only rule it out as a phony if the phoniness is extremely obvious in the case of a frisbee or a hubcap or a garbage can lid or something like this. But there's sort of a quite a large group of photographs in which we have only the word of one photographer and we have a very bad quality picture. And by a great deal of work, we can only come to some conclusion as to the possibility that the thing is genuine. But we very infrequently can come out and say, yes, this is a picture of a vehicle. This is much more difficult than it seems.
It was a clear sunny day, the 24th of June, the year 1947. Veteran private pilot and businessman Kenneth Arnold had flown his small craft a few miles off course to see if he could spot the wreckage of a missing Army transport aircraft believed to have crashed near Tacoma, Washington. He was intently observing the mountain slopes when he became aware that he was not alone in the sky. His attention was drawn to and became instantly riveted upon nine shimmering disc-like objects that were flashing in and out among the neighboring peaks at an estimated 1,000 miles an hour and looking for all the world like they were playing a glorious game of follow the leader. Arnold's reputation for shrewdness as a pilot, coupled with his detailed description of the craft and his sincerity of manner, won the confidence of the skeptical news reporters, and his story was given full coverage. It flashed around the world with the newly coined descriptive term flying saucers included in the account.
An organization exists called the UFO Education Center. They're located in both Appleton, Wisconsin, and California, and they have two 24-hour telephone lines, and people are encouraged to call in sightings from around the country. They are somewhat of a clearinghouse for UFO information. The UFO Education Center is manned by Charlotte Reed, who is the associate director in California. With her is a gentleman by the name of Dr. Thomas Hyman, who is the assistant executive director of the center.
The reason for this existence is to help bring the field, as it's been called, of UFOs, or I would prefer to call them extraterrestrial visits or visitations, to the public as a specifically a consumer issue, something that should involve all citizens actively, and not that they should belong to anything, because in fact there is no membership that is asked of by this work, but rather to help create a meaningful, a sympathetic dialogue among all citizens from all walks of life, because it's certainly from all walks of life where people have been having their experiences with these craft, and to bring about a tolerance and, you might say, a listening ear on the part of everybody, wherever they may be. In other words, it's the desire to create more open feeling upon all people in the public, whether they be in schools or universities, civic group, community leaders, so that we can talk about this openly and sanely and listen to each other. This is the main goal here, because there is something truly profound happening, and does involve what we feel from the evidence shows definitely peaceful visitation, not from this planet.
Now you have a telephone number that you publicize, and you try to get it as well known as possible around the country. The fact that you have this telephone number, you have two numbers, you have one in California, you have one in Appleton, Wisconsin. You publicize the fact that you can call day or night, that it's open 24 hours, and the key line that you use is serving law enforcement and the public. Give our number to all citizens is what you emphasize in your literature that you send to various radio stations around the country.
That's right.
Now there's no money in this, is there?
Well, No, as a matter of fact, we as teachers and also as volunteers do this, again, on a voluntary basis. We do not take salaries. It is not, as a matter of fact, we are registered by the federal government as a non-profit, tax-exempt organization because of our structure. We feel, on the basis of our individual study and experiences, and many people who are working with us have had their own experiences citing these crafts, that it is something demanding attention and should be given serious, thoughtful attention by everyone without bickering, without name-calling, in order to help, you know, get to the bottom of it. It's going to take a lot of listening. We feel that there is daylight evidence that must be looked at carefully, such as by George Adamski, by Cedric Allingham, by people from many walks of life who have taken daytime pictures and, in fact, even concerning human being occupants that have been seen, again, not under some strange lighting conditions at nighttime or what have you, but actually in broad daylight.
Okay, Tom, let's get into that here in just a second. I'm interested in you've got these two lines now in the United
right.
States.
Let's, can I give those numbers?
I'm sorry?
May I give those numbers
let's
to the public?
Let's do that at the end. I'll emphasize that, and as a matter of fact, on several occasions throughout the program, I promise you that I will give these numbers out to the public.
Fine.
How many calls, Tom, do you average, let's say in the average week? How many people are actually calling your line informing you about these sightings?
All right. There, of course, people call for different reasons, but as far as the sightings go, I would say that they're any one of the headquarters, I'd say approximately anywhere from a dozen to two dozen calls during the week, depending upon the time of year, and that, you know, people may be out more looking up, weather might be more clear, and this kind of thing.
All right, let's say hypothetically that we get that you get a telephone call, and it sounds pretty legitimate to you. It is something that you can relate to as being a fairly substantial story using the background of information that you have gathered over the years in working with these types of reports. And let's say you get something that sounds fairly legitimate. Okay, how useful is this to you, and what do you do with that information after you collect it?
Well, first of all, we would have to check as much as possible to see how this information could be verified by other witnesses. This could be determined also if they are willing to leave their name. Sometimes people don't even want to have their names used, but that's quite all right. We understand. I would say this, though. We would certainly value information more highly if people themselves would put their name by and stand up for it. Otherwise, it's very difficult to completely trust that kind of a report. I would say, after trying to check over all possibilities of satellites, meteorites, airplanes in flight, birds in flight, many different kinds of explanations, which we try very gently and not hostilely, certainly, but just very sympathetically to try to see what all the things that could be ruled out. We then will find some corroborating information, possibly by contacting law enforcement agencies or Air Force bases, people in that given area, and see if there have been other reports. Now, that information that we do get, we log, and we try to keep as careful a log of some, you know, basic types of characteristics of what is seen and the attitudes of the people during their experience. And from that point, we want to help the public understand, so sometimes we will mention these sightings to the press. If the people who will call in, and I would like to repeat this for your listeners, if they do release the fact to us that they would not mind having their experience be quoted coming from then we will. If they do not want their names to be used, we certainly will not use it.
I understand that you also collect photographs as well.
Yes, photographs or films. As a matter of fact, in the files of our director and founder, Charlotte Globe, who is known internationally for her work, there are beautiful daylight films which have been taken, some of them exceptionally close and showing great detail of these crafts. And some of the clearest of material has been taken by George Adamski, by Cedric Allingham, by an architect in Peru who took a beautiful still shot in 1973. And as a matter of fact, we find that there are children with instamatics. We shouldn't berate the lowly instamatic, because there are some excellent shots that have been taken by very simple cameras.
What you're really seeing then is that it is this history of the UFOs or these extraterrestrial vehicles having been throughout history searching and researching, understanding and analyzing, if you will, planet Earth, and to this day they have yet to indicate any form of aggression towards mankind. It is that
right.
And that alone that makes you feel that they absolutely must be peaceful beings.
Not only that, but we are on the brink of being a space civilization ourselves, and to the point of even joining in a type of community, if you will, of space. They are not seeking any conquest even at this time, but I think what we have to look at very carefully is what are the experiences that people are having with these craft. There's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of subjective fear that people are giving because they are just simply not familiar with the kind of frequencies or the kind of lighting, the kind of events that are taking place. And this is what is needed to be done, is to talk about it, to make this more of a continually open public information discussion, not hide it under statistics, not hide it under government programs for year after year. I might say I know we're rushing through in a very short period of time, but I have had an experience with these craft that left me with such a most beautiful and peaceful feeling, and this involved anywhere from 80 to 100 of these ships at one moment crossing the skies in central Mexico, and I would say one of the most beautiful experiences of my life, and they crossed the sky, they left enormous ribbons of light behind them. Certainly with all that power, if they had any hostility in mind as being an armada, conquest, if you will, we all could have been mincemeat a long time ago, but obviously that was not their point.
Tom, which came first, your involvement with the UFO Education Center or this experience in Mexico?
Oh, no, my involvement was first. By the way, that sighting witnessed by thousands of Mexicans, and we have the articles to prove it when it took place in 1967, is massively seen throughout the central area of Mexico. No, I became very interested in studying this. I had been living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I was quite a skeptic. I thought that the evidence of such a George Adamski's was just interesting, but so what? And looking at a lot of different evidence, I finally realized that there was more to it. I began digging. I just didn't take what I heard on one radio program or one newspaper interview or one TV documentary, but I felt there was something very important that had to be learned. And certainly what we can do is at least to, and I found this, you can't persuade anybody. It's pointless to try to say and expect that you're going to persuade somebody. But at least what you can do is this, is to excite their sense of curiosity and a feeling that there is something really important, a whole body of information, which is going unnoticed or glossed over or treated as a comic relief for our newsprint. And I think and when you make a discovery like this, you realize that there has been, as one of our directors has said, perhaps there has been consumer fraud. And what we have been told over the years as being, well, this is negligible, let's forget it. It's almost like the way we're told to forget background radiation. We're told to forget about a lot of hazardous things and chemicals in our environment, which now we say, well, hey, we better be concerned about it. So this is an environmental issue that involves sociological and philosophical questions, legal questions in terms of space law. We're talking about building habitats. NASA is seriously talking about building space habitats and developing even with our own technology. So we've got to start thinking about these questions, and all of us are going to be moved to our foundations, and each one of us, to grapple with the idea that what we were taught about the humanity being alone, what we were taught about this planet and the civilization being self-justifying, we're going to be, I think, humbled by the experience, as even the astronauts were, by being space people in a space civilization. And I think this is what the planet Earth is involved in right now.
Thomas Hyman, Assistant Executive Director of the UFO Education Center in California, and then their other office, which is located in Appleton, Wisconsin. The UFO Education Center is a nonprofit effort by concerned educators and citizens providing communication and understanding in the public interest.
There are many other inhabited worlds, and on some of them, beings exist who are immeasurably beyond our mental level. We should be rash to deny that they can use radiation so penetrating as to convey messages to Earth. Probably such messages come now. When they are first made intelligible, A new era in the history of humanity dawns. At the beginning of the new era, the opposition between those who welcome the new knowledge and those who deem it dangerously subversive may lead to a world war. But I should like to be living then, when we begin this new era. We might get a true understanding of the beginning of the universe.
Views expressed by the late Bishop Barnes, quite anticipating his times. He said those words in 1931. Radio astronomers in the United States tried briefly in 1960 to intercept any possible intelligent transmissions from a couple of solar systems about 11.5 light years away. If anybody out there was talking, the Americans weren't tuned in, at least maybe not on the right wavelengths, so they gave up after a few months. No similar attempt has been undertaken since that time. Most scientists now believe that there must be literally billions of planets in the universe, enough like Earth to sustain life. On some of them, where life may have gotten started a little bit earlier, technological civilizations, superior to ours, may have developed and flourished for a while. It is at least conceivable that many of them sent feelers of one kind or another out into space in an attempt to establish some kind of contact. So there may not be billions of planets rich in many kinds of life lacking the intelligence which created the technological civilization of planet Earth. As some see it, the ultimate question is whether intelligence necessarily has what the evolutionists call survival value. If it does, then intelligence almost certainly evolved on all those other worlds. If it does not, and the success of non-intelligent insects on Earth suggests that intelligence may be overrated from the standpoint of survival, then there is no compelling reason to think that sentient life is commonplace in the universe. As certainly as one scientist said, it is exciting to speculate that intelligence is more dominant in the great world of the stars, as on Earth, than mere instinct. But something more than intelligence, or even civilization, is required for communication amongst the stars. What is required is a high degree of technological sophistication of the kind possessed on planet Earth only by those beings who have mastered the art of extending their own limited senses into the electromagnetic ranges of invisible light, radio waves, X-rays, and gamma rays. Are we alone?